Episode 2, Life Will Never Be The Same Again. Things were getting desperate now. I could see Julie mentally deteriorating. She was now in a lot of discomfort. She was permanently on oxygen and had a line long enough to reach the bathroom. On Saturday evening, I took her in the wheelchair to the hospital shop so she could look around and buy something. She didn't really want anything. She just wanted to look and have a change of scenery. I could see her wince with every bump. When we returned to the room, she settled back down and then said, "I'm not suicidal, but I could throw myself under a bus." I replied, "Well, it's a good job that you can barely make it to the bathroom, never mind the bus stop." For Julie to say that meant she was truly struggling with a constant pain and lack of sleep. The only pain relief given to her was paracetamol and the lowest amount of morphine. The doctor said it was because they were concerned her heart couldn't take it. But she would have been better off having a heart attack and leaving all this misery behind. All the time I felt calm. I felt I needed to show Julie that I was calm and strong. A real sense of peace was growing in me. My thought process was clear and solid. I just needed to get her home where I could look after her in familiar surroundings, where she could sleep in her own bed, where she could see her family and they could see her. Exactly 4 weeks after she entered hospital and 6 weeks since the pain had started, the hospital were finally going to allow Julie to start her chemotherapy. She was going to have a half dose as her heart was weak and so was her strength now. She was due to have it first thing Thursday morning. Thursday morning came and as usual the chemotherapy had been delayed and was now taking place on Friday morning. I was now getting used to things being cancelled on the last minute. Friday morning came and the chemotherapy was delayed again, so early on Friday afternoon, after 4 weeks of waiting, she finally started the treatment. Julie wasn't sure if she wanted me to visit that evening, as she didn't know how she'd be feeling after the treatment. I asked her to contact me to tell me how things were going and how she was feeling. I worked that day, and in the late afternoon I was still waiting for contact from her. I tried to call and text her but got no response. It got to 6 p.m. I'd been working in the village. The village was near the bypass that took me to the hospital. This was closer than going home. So I decided to go and have a drink and wait there to see if Julie would call me. I saw a friend of mine. I ordered a drink and went to sit down with him when suddenly my phone rang. At last, I thought, contact from Julie. But when I looked, I noticed it was a number I didn't recognise. It must be the hospital. This was the first time that the hospital had contacted me in the 4 weeks since Julie had been there. The only thought I had was, this is bad news. I found a quiet spot and answered the phone. It was the hospital, and I was asked by a male nurse if I could make my way to the ward. I asked if Julie was okay, but he wouldn't say anything but repeat his request. I left the pub immediately and started running towards my van, knowing that something bad had happened. It's about a 15 to 20 minute drive to the hospital from the village. And though I remained calm, all my thoughts were preparing me for the inevitable bad news I was about to face. I entered the ward at about 6:30 p.m. and was brought to a private room. Within a minute, I was joined by the female doctor who had been looking after Julie. You could feel a real sorrow in her. Her face painted a picture, and that picture said 1,000 words. None of them good. Apologetically, she told me that Julie had had a reaction to the chemotherapy and that she wasn't going to make it through the night. The doctor said that they sedated her and made her comfortable. I asked if Julie was in any pain and she assured me that she wasn't. Even though she hadn't contacted me to discuss Julie's illness or progress, and that I thought that she should have administered the chemotherapy a lot earlier when Julie was stronger, I also understood that this was a balancing act, trying to prevent Julie from having a heart attack. The one thing I did know for sure is, she cared for Julie and did what she thought was right at the time. You can only do your best with the tools that are given and the situation you find yourself in. We both entered the room Julie was staying in. The first thing I remember was the oxygen was now on full blast. My mind quickly jumped back to the first time I saw Julie in hospital just over 2 weeks earlier. I remember seeing the little ball jumping about a fifth of the way up the oxygen tube and hearing the light hissing sound and thinking to myself, if that ball reached the top of the tube, you'd have to be in a bad way. The little ball was now at the top of the tube and it wasn't dancing anymore. It was rooted at the summit. The hissing sound was now like a car tyre being deflated. It seemed so loud. The doctor apologised again and asked me if there was anything that she could get me or if I wanted her to contact anyone. I took one look at Julie lay on her back, eyes half open, looking straight up, taking huge gulps of air in a controlled rhythm, and thought to myself, she's not going to last long now. Nobody's going to have time to get here. I thanked the doctor and declined the offer. I sat down on the chair to the left-hand side of the bed, holding my wife's hand, talking to her, kissing her forehead and wiping away any mucus she had from her nose and mouth. She would have hated being in that state, and I knew I needed to make her feel dignified. Some people would think that she wouldn't know what state she was in. Of course she'd know. Just because she was heavily sedated and lifeless, it didn't mean that she didn't know what was going on. Time seemed to go so quickly, and the amount of times it looked like it was going to be her last breath was ridiculous. I said to her countless numbers of times, you just go now, love, just go. I wanted her out of this misery. I knew my Nana was waiting for her. I knew she was in safe hands. Then suddenly, Julie did something that still amazes me today when I think about it. Between 20 minutes to half an hour of me sitting beside her, when she took one of her massive gulps of air, she somehow lifted her head and plunked it down so she was looking at me. In all that time, she hadn't moved a muscle. Her eyes had remained half opened and she hadn't blinked. All she had done was inhale deeply every 3 to 4 seconds to a regular rhythm. How did she do that? I knew that girl was strong, but oh my God, that's totally blown me away. She's done that for me, I thought. I remember telling her how much I loved her. A nurse friend of mine said that she'd seen patients do that before, as if it was just a body twitching or surging. That was no twitch or surge. That was perfectly timed and totally controlled. Julie was telling me that she loved me and she was determined to be facing me when she eventually said her last goodbye. I realised the effort and inner strength it must have taken to do that. I added that thought to my Nana waiting for her and the fact that she'd soon be with her beloved father as another positive and part of my eventual recovery. The strength she must have gathered to lift her head and then for it to land perfectly in place without blinking was remarkable. The cynics can say what they want. I know what I saw and I know how I felt. Over the years, we've always been very much in tune mentally and spiritually. And on reflection, that last act from her really doesn't surprise me. After probably the fastest hour of my life, Julie was still alive, and I was now thinking I should have rang people to give them a chance to see her. I rang my son and he said he was going to make his way down to the hospital. I rang my daughter who was away with her fiancé. They were about 3 hours' drive away, but she said she was going to pack up now and head home. I rang Julie's mum and stepmum, but they both declined the offer. They were both too upset and wanted to remember Julie the way that they'd always known her and not to have that mental image of her struggling in a hospital bed. I think it was a wise move by both of them. It wasn't a pretty sight and neither of them had been able to see her in hospital beforehand, so it would have been a massive shock. My son arrived about 8 p.m. and sat down next to his mum. He's a very quiet, caring and calm boy, but has this amazing inner strength that not many people know about. But his mum and I did. He sees life as it is, life, and he sees death as part of life. He's a realist, and him getting there on time was part of his recovery. He was mentally strong enough to face seeing his mum in that condition and would still be able to continue with his life with a positive outlook. It was also important for his mum to see him and have that time together before she departed this earth. At 9:40 p.m, Julie took her last breath. Her son was sat at the side of the bed, holding her hand. I suddenly felt a real calmness come over me, almost a psychedelic buzzing inside. I didn't feel sadness, just calm. If anything, I felt relief. I contacted the nurse to tell her Julie had died. She was visibly upset. I noticed over the couple of weeks I'd been visiting the hospital how popular Julie was with the nurses and cleaners. Not because she was a joker or a loud character, but because she oozed the warmth that people gravitated to. A doctor was now needed to clarify the death, and after waiting a while we found out that there was only one doctor on duty that night, and he was on A&E. We waited until midnight and then resigned to the fact that it could be 6 a.m. before we got time to see the body. Reluctantly, we left Julie and headed home. That was a weird feeling driving home, and even though Julie hadn't been home for a month, opening the front door and entering our house as a widower was as peculiar as hell. I stayed up for a few hours thinking about what had just happened, and knowing that nothing would ever be the same again. I also contemplated the best way to approach our family and friends with the news. The majority of them didn't even know that Julie was ill, as she didn't want bombarding with messages and calls on a daily basis whilst in hospital. Julie was one who just wanted leaving alone when she wasn't well. No fuss. We decided to let everyone know the situation once we got Julie home, but that never happened. I decided that I needed to see as many people face to face to tell them the news. In my eyes, this was the right thing to do. I also decided that for the rest of my days, I wasn't going to avoid talking about Julie. If the subject arose, no matter what situation I was in, I was going to talk about her. Because I was expecting Julie to come home after the first session of chemo, I'd made a load of food and vacuum packed it. I'd become quite an accomplished cook over the years, and had just converted my garage into a kitchen so I could cook professionally when Julie suddenly became ill. I was going to hand out the food I'd made to family and friends, some who knew Julie was ill but most who didn't, inform them of Julie's condition and ask them to send their energies, think of her and enjoy a meal on us. This was a little different now. I now had to tell them that Julie had died. The following morning, I stood leaning against the open French doors, looking onto the back garden, pondering. The sun was shining, it was the end of August and it was a really lovely day. That's when I saw my first sign. Small, discreet, but definitely a sign from Julie. It brought a smile to my face. I knew she'd send me a sign telling me that she was safe, but I didn't think it'd be this soon. The first place I went to was my local pub. If I wasn't working, I usually went there on a Saturday for a couple of drinks at lunchtime to say hello to the regulars. They didn't know Julie, but knew she wasn't well and had supported me. It's a lovely little bar in the village, about the size of a small shop. I walked in to find the regulars were in, about 10 of them, all friends. They all greeted me as usual. Before sitting down, I just stood there in the middle of the bar with a carrier bag of food in my hand. I composed myself and then said, "I know some of you know Julie's been ill, and I'd made a load of food so you could all have a meal on us and think of my wife, but unfortunately, Julie died last night. So if you'd like to help yourself and think about her as you have your meal, I'd really appreciate that." I then put the bag of food on the bar. I can't even remember if I stayed for a drink. I don't think I did, as I had a lot of people to see and contact that day. I then went to see other close friends who all lived nearby. I rang most of my remaining family and friends that day, and the last people I went to see were my mum and stepdad. They lived about half an hour away and didn't have a clue Julie had even been ill. I asked my sister-in-law to meet me there, as I wanted to get straight back home afterwards to make sure my son was okay, but I didn't want to leave my mum and stepdad alone after hearing the news. I remember that evening, sat alone in my lounge thinking, I'm so glad I faced the music today and told as many people as I could face to face. Not only was it the right thing to do, but it allowed them to see how I was. It alleviated any worry they might have regarding how I was coping. It also stopped people bombarding me with phone calls and messages on a daily basis, and that allowed me to breathe, to think, to grieve. My three rules of surviving bereavement. Rule number one, give yourself as much time as you need to think alone. Do not underestimate how important this is. It's more important than anything else. Rule number two, under no circumstances feel sorry for yourself. You've nothing to feel sorry about. This is life. There are people a lot worse off than you. Rule number three, be brave. Do it the hard way, because the hard way is normally the right way. Knowing that you've done the right thing is so important in your recovery from any situation, but in bereavement, not only do you know that you've done the right thing by your family and friends, but most importantly, you've done the right thing by the deceased. I know Julie will be looking down on me, proud of the way that I acted. It's important to put yourself in difficult situations and come out fighting. You don't know how strong you are until you put yourself into a corner. Doing things the right way is normally the harder things to do. Spiritually, this is your first thought. The thought that you're spiritually advised to do. Your pure thought, the right thing to do. Your second thought is your thought. It's an easier and more selfish option that will benefit you more than others. Try to get used to listening to your first thought and acting on it. I sat on the couch on Sunday morning, content that the events from the day before had been handled in the right way. This was a big mental tick on my to-do list, but the list was long and I knew it was only going to get longer. I knew that there'd be a lot of messages to come from people who had heard the news secondhand. It was about 11 a.m. I opened the front door and there was a bunch of flowers on the doorstep from Julie's cousin Luke. He'd knocked on, but I hadn't heard him. My side of the family is quite big, but Julie's was very small. She had no siblings, three cousins, two aunties, one uncle, her mum and stepmum. I'd not seen Luke for years. I rang him and he came around. He was obviously stunned that Julie had died. He stayed a couple of hours and then left to visit Julie's mum. Later that afternoon, I got another unexpected visit from Luke's older brother, Mark. Mark was Julie's best friend while growing up. Of the cousins, Mark is the nearest to Julie's age, but older. They'd grown up together, hung round with each other, gone to concerts together, worked together. They were very close. I was close to Mark as well. We'd always got on very well. He's a very good friend of mine. Mark was obviously stunned by the news, but he wasn't one to show a lot of emotion. I offered him dinner and to stay over, as he lived well over an hour's drive away. He accepted the invitation. After dinner, we started to tuck into a tray of beers I had. We stayed in the kitchen, slowly drinking, not getting drunk, just chatting and reminiscing. Neither of us could still believe what had happened. It just didn't seem real. At 11:30 p.m, Mark went out the back door for a cigarette. The night was totally still and warm. It was t-shirt weather. The step down from the kitchen is about 25 centimetres, and Mark was stood approximately a metre away from me as I stood on the doorstep. I know Mark was stood this close, as I was thinking to myself, he stood a bit too close. I don't want the smell of cigarettes to come into the house. As we were talking, a small fluffy white feather softly floated down perfectly between our noses. We both stopped, mesmerised by what was happening. It carried on slowly dropping towards the floor due to land about half a metre outside on the concrete. Then on the last second, it suddenly swept in and landed perfectly between my feet on the doormat. Mark was just stood there, not believing what he'd seen. He's a total sceptic. I turned and shouted to my son, "Come quick, your mum's here." We looked up. There's no bird flying at that time of night. That feather was placed perfectly between our noses as if somebody had dropped it from a few inches above our heads. And how did it shoot into the house and land on the mat perfectly between my feet? Even Mark couldn't explain it, though he wanted to. My son is also a total sceptic and refuses to believe anything that isn't scientifically proven. Julie would later send him a private message that I think even he found hard to disbelieve. I gave my son the feather and told him to look after it. The day after was Monday, and though there'd been tears and very sad periods each day, I kept thinking to myself that I was handling this a bit too well. The Tuesday arrived and one of our best friends came to visit in the morning. Lisa had lived a couple of doors down from us when we first moved into the area. She was very close to Julie. I was telling Lisa that I was feeling guilty as I felt I was handling the situation too well. Lisa left about lunchtime and a couple of hours later, without warning, I mentally dropped like a stone. I couldn't believe it. I've had some really tough times in my life and somehow got through them to continue along the right path. But I've never experienced that feeling of total hopelessness and lack of drive. This was alien to me. I'm a positive person. I control my energies and I've done for nearly 20 years, but this was like my body refused to do what my brain was requesting. I was saying to myself, just stand up and make yourself a brew. Nothing. I then gave myself a count, ready, on three, stand up, 1, 2, 3, nothing. My body totally refused to cooperate. It took me such a long time to get off that couch. I suddenly realised how people with depression felt. Really not a nice feeling, not a nice position to be in. It still seems hard for me to believe how I felt when I think back to it. I remember that I had to really dig deep over the next few days to slowly kickstart the process of building myself back up. I could feel myself wanting to slip back into that depressive state. I felt giving up was the more natural thing to do, just to let the depression totally take over. It was like I was floating on the edge of a whirlpool, ready to be sucked in if I stopped paddling. About a week later, I felt like I was back to the way I was before the depression. I'd just spent a week in a daze, fighting a demon, yo-yoing between simply feeling down to some very dark moments in very dark places. The speed that it ascended on me was scary. I decided that I needed to ensure I was aware of my mental state at all times and to keep my mental awareness levels very high. So if I had another episode like before, then I'd only fall halfway. I could recover quickly from halfway, but if my mental state wasn't great to start with and I mentally dropped, then I'd drop to rock bottom, and that's not a nice place to be and a very difficult place to lift yourself from. I knew that I could drop at any moment. I knew I needed to be aware, and I also knew I had such a long way to go before any form of normality was possible. Being aware that you're vulnerable is really important, but being one step ahead to safeguard yourself is absolutely vital. Just because you haven't had a repeat of a mental lapse for some time doesn't mean you won't have one. Close the gate before the horse bolts. In the next episode, a visit from old friends allows Julie to say hello in dramatic fashion, and an inadvertent comment provides me with a huge mental boost.